With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to this week's episode of the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week. Apologies to anyone who has been missing the podcast over the last few weeks. We haven't put out an episode. It has been heads down at the Video Week offices, I'm afraid. We've been working on a major piece of research, which is extremely time-consuming, although thoroughly enjoyable, and we're very excited about the results. It's a piece of research that looks at the European CTV advertising market. We've been doing that in association with Podmatic, and we'll be launching that in a couple of weeks. This week's episode is from New Video Frontiers. If you did see Sir Martin Sorrell speak on the day, this is an extended version of that interview. It was a very much an enjoyable interview. As always, Sir Martin was on form, unique insights, plenty of swipes at his former colleagues at WPP, and we also discussed China and the opportunities and challenges associated with that interesting market. The good news is that we've got lots of podcast content in the bank, and we will be putting those out in quick succession over the next few weeks. We've got Rory Sutherland and Tess Alps from New Video Frontiers. Again, both of those will be extended versions of the interviews that we put out on the day. The good news is that we've got lots of podcast content in the bank, and we will be putting those out in quick succession over the next few weeks. We've got Rory Sutherland and Tess Alps from New Video Frontiers. Again, both of those will be extended versions of the interviews that we put out on the day. We also have some episodes with Austin Scott, who heads up video development at Xandr, and Amy Williams, CEO of Goodloop. So if you haven't subscribed already and you're listening to this on desktop, I recommend that you take out your podcast reader and subscribe. I also recommend that if you're like me and you find yourself stuck at your desk a lot more than you really should be, getting out for a walk with a podcast, whether it's our podcast or anyone else's, is a great way to break up your day and not feel quite so guilty that you're out skiving. So I'll cross over now to my conversation with Sir Martin. Yeah, I hope you enjoy. So Martin, S4 Capital's market cap has grown to over £2 billion now. You're up to, that's about roughly about 25% of WPP's market cap. How have you managed to scale, you know, the business so quickly this time around? And how long do you think it'll be before you grow to a comparable size of WPP? You know, might we even one day see you returning to WPP and saying, you know, I'm back and I've, you know, reacquiring the company?
That's extremely doubtful. I mean, there are nice bits of WPP, but there's not much of it that we covered. I mean, there's some nice bits around VML, I think, and AKQA and digital content bits like that. There's Essence and Xaxis, which I think are good. There's Kantar World Panel, but they've already jettisoned that to Bain Capital. Although Bain Capital, from what I see and hear, is sort of struggling a little bit with all that. A lot of consultants in at Bain Capital. Somebody told me that they're paying their consultants £6 million a month, would you believe, to tell them what they should have already known, or if they'd asked anybody at WPP, they could have told them. No, there aren't many bits there that we would be interested in. We're really interested in this purely digital focus, in this holy trinity, as we've probably inadequately called it, you know, first party data driving the creation of digital advertising content, pumping that out programmatically with digital media in a continuous loop, rather like an electoral model, without an election date, if you like. Faster, better, cheaper, or speed, quality, value. Faster being about agility, better being understanding the digital ecosystem, or the balance and how the balance is shifting in it. And then lastly, efficiency. And then our fourth fundamental founding principle is around a unitary structure, one P&L. You know, they the holding companies all talk about it, but they can't deliver it. Hopeless at delivering it when you talk to clients. But we're really from the very beginning focused on that. So the reason that we've grown quickly is we're very ambitious. You know, our mission is to create or develop the new age, new era advertising and marketing services model. And to disrupt the old model. I mean, there's a missionary zeal here. There's something that's a bit like a sect, a weird sect of people who are determined to disrupt the old. So, you know, grand examples like a Tesla in the automotive sector is really a software company that's disrupting the automotive sector, or Amazon in obviously online shopping or in the retail market. So it's a new model that we're trying to build. Those are grand examples. But so I don't really compare ourselves in market cap or whatever to WPP. I mean, the gap between us and WPP is closed very significantly. I think we're ranked about 150, 160 in the FTSE. I think WPP is now back to about 60, 65. So the gap is getting narrower, but that's not primarily what drives us, is that mission around creating the new age, new era model and disrupting the old. But, you know, we're growing because we're where the growth is. That's the whole thing about S4, the model, unlike WPP and unlike Saatchi's before it, is it's not about a value-based model. Is there's this sort of juxtaposition between value and growth. And we are focused on growth, not growth to the exclusion of margins. We think margins are important, but like-for-like store growth, as retailers call it, or that's the biggest driver of total shareholder return. And people don't seem to understand that you go where the growth is. So having struggled in the last few years with WPP and the top-line growth, I didn't want to be in a position where I struggled again with that. So we're growing. We're going where the growth is, and we all grow where the growth is.
And do you feel that WPP is, you know, is it capable of reform? You know, it can, you know, the holy trinity of first party data, digital media, and content. I mean, those components surely are.
WPP won't change unless it blows itself up. So I mean, you know, it's like turkeys don't vote for Christmas. So Mark Reed and his crew of CBOs, as I call them, chief breakfast officers, won't vote for Christmas. They're not turkeys that vote for Christmas. Unfortunately, the only way that WPP will change is if they were prepared to step down. If they stepped down and broke the company up, then it would change. But absent that, it won't change. It'll just lumber on, adding more people at the center and more CBOs, as I call them, those chief breakfast officers. More, they don't shuffle pieces of paper anymore. They shuffle emails to one another. They drive the people inside. You talk to people inside the operating companies. It would be good if you did a little conference with the operating companies, maybe anonymously, because they won't talk publicly about it, but privately, they're beyond despair. You know, you see all the things that are happening in Australia just today. If the press just dug, or analysts dug a little bit deeply into it, they'd uncover, you know, pick up the stones. They'd uncover an awful lot. I mean, it's pathetic, really. But it's the way of the world, I'm afraid.
So when setting out that Holy Trinity roadmap again, you know, first party data, digital media, and content. Is that still the core vision, or is there, you know, yes, is there anything looming on the horizon as a fourth pillar?
No, I think you know, our competition is not the holding companies. I think they're negligible competition there. I mean, it's the bits of the holding company. So recent tech pitch, which we won, was against Huge and RGA and AKQA, and so we compete with the bits that I would cover, if you like, within the holding companies. But our chief competition is Accenture. You know, take BMW, for example. I mean, the people who are sorest about losing that or losing that opportunity is Accenture, but particularly because they have a very significant position with BMW already. So I would say that's where the competition is. We do compete with a Deloitte on a limited basis, or a PW, but much less. It's Accenture. So when you think about Accenture, I mean, it's huge. We're comparing a pimple with an elephant, really, or a pimple on the elephant's backside. You know, they're 150 billion market cap, 50 billion of revenue. You know, we're 2.5 billion, 2.6, $2.7 billion market cap, and we're $450 million of revenue, so $500 million of revenue. So we're very small by comparison. So if you think about Accenture, you know, systems integration, consulting, moving up the funnel, you know, becoming more strategic. So coming back to your question, if there are three areas around data, around content, and digital media, I think more of a consulting capability, more of a systems integration capability. Those are the two areas where you naturally expect to see us expand, but it's sort of driven by those four principles of digital only, because that's where the growth is, the holy trinity: faster, better, cheaper, or speed, quality, value, and last but not least, the unitary structure. So that's really it. So, you know, a bit further up the value chain, if you like, less activation and implementation, more strategic thinking, if you like, and more consulting capability and more systems integration.
Early in the year, you know, as the pandemic sort of kicked in, you sort of felt that what we were going to see is a V-shaped recession. Now, obviously, the situation has developed considerably since then. We know a bit more about what's happening. Are there any economies or perhaps sectors within economies that you think are going to ride out the storm better than others?
Yeah, well, so, you know, I modified that thinking. I mean, it's still V-shaped in part, so I liken it to the reverse square root. I like that analogy because it's sharp dip, sharp rise, and then a plateau, maybe not at the level that we were before immediately. The swoosh, I don't like it as an analogy because it implies that you're going to outperform where you were pretty quickly. I don't think that's going to be the case. It's going to be a bit more of a struggle. But then there are V-shaped parts of the economy. So tech, clearly, which is the heartland of our business, about 55% of our revenues come from tech, or healthcare, you know, adds another 5% to make it about 60% of our businesses. Tech and healthcare, that's where we're seeing more V-shaped online shopping, in-home gaming and entertainment, online financial services. You know, you look at the banks that are reporting their Q3 today or in the next few days, you'll see, I think, that their online activities along with the online activities of most companies have been extremely strong. So there's a more V-shape. The U-shaped are probably sort of the sort of smaller U's, or the less bottomed U's, the smaller, the thinner U's would be around the more focused FMCGs like a L'Oreal or a Kellogg's or General Mills. Sometimes their portfolios were pre-COVID, not as contemporary as they've become during COVID, if you like. But, you know, a Procter who sold its food business, Unilever, has done quite well, but has suffered a bit on the foods side, food service and ice cream because of lack of distribution in COVID. You know, a L'Oreal, which are very focused, or a Colgate, very focused, has done better, you know, around sort of oral and healthcare and pet food, so, or pets, as suffered less, if you like. So that's the sort of U-shaped, and then the L-shaped of travel and hospitality. I haven't noticed many chair shapes. Those are the ones that have gone off the map. But I'm sure, you know, after the furloughs, probably some, you know, the L-shaped, the chair shape tends to be, it's unkind to make these sort of observations, but sadly, when the furloughs come off, it's going to be the small and medium-sized businesses that get it in the neck, which is terrible. And I think this actually brings us to an important point around regulation. Be careful what you wish for. Those platforms, those much criticized platforms, I think unfairly criticized platforms, are the engines of small and medium-sized business growth. Jack Ma, Alibaba, understands that. You know, he continuously points this out, that Alibaba is the engine of small business, of entrepreneurial business in China. And as Alibaba expands outside China, and Alipay and the logistics platform, these are the engines of small business. Google, Facebook, Amazon should be hammering that message home to Congress and others. You know, be careful in terms of, if you do regulate them, if you do break them up, if they have a detrimental impact at this time on small and medium-sized businesses, which, by the way, are the engine of employment. So a lot of the growth in employment comes from the small and medium-sized businesses. So don't kill them off.
Yeah. I mean, we're obviously seeing big moves on the antitrust side, but both in Europe and in the US at the moment. you know, within our media industry, I think there is a feeling that they do have too much power, that they have too many different points of leverage which they can.
So which industry are you referring to?
Well, within
when you media, say our media.
Within media and advertising, I think, you know.
But that's a big industry. So do you mean the media owners or do you mean traditional media owners? I can understand that. But that's a bit King Canute-like, isn't it? I mean, these, like it or not, you know, I was looking at the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, you know, which points out or tries to point out. I mean, it's a long film, but there's one basic message that these platforms have too much power and they sort of manipulate us. It's a bit like Vance Packard and Hidden Persuaders. I mean, it's a rerun of that, but in a different, to my mind, but in a different era. It was ever thus. I mean, we've had, you know, I can remember subliminal advertising. You remember that, you know, you went into a cinema and without you knowing, they flashed, you know, Coca-Cola at you or Pepsi Cola at you without you knowing. And you went out and bought gallons of Coca-Cola or Pepsi Cola as a result. No, there's always been this strain. It's become more extreme because of the pervasive nature of the technology. Now, I don't believe, look, I think the platforms are behaving more responsibly. I think Google, Facebook, and Amazon, and Apple, and Microsoft, as they've gone across through $1 trillion of market cap, or most of them, Facebook hasn't, but the others have, you know, with power comes responsibility. And I think they are acknowledging that. Facebook employs, 35,000 people to monitor editorial content. They've got rid of some of the extreme groups, the Boogaloo groups, for example. They've tried to deal with hate speech. It is very difficult. It is reprehensible. You know, these articles, that, you know, as a Jew, I extremely sensitive to the point of denying the Holocaust, which I find loathsome, but or beyond loathsome, and not prepared to accept. So, you know, I do share that view that there are extremes that have to be dealt with, but they are trying to deal with it, and it is very difficult in a concept or in an ecosystem that is so sophisticated, so big, 2 billion people or whatever it happens to be. Look at the benefits that these platforms have given in terms of connecting people, the marginal cost of information, zero. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, the revolution that has taken place and the impact that it's had on our lives. And with that, unfortunately, come some negatives that have to be dealt with. And I'm sure that, I don't happen to believe that the boycotts do much good. I think what needs to be done is regulators, our clients have to sit down. Again, I liken it to dealing with the Chinese. You score any plus points or gain any advantage by sort of punching the Chinese in the nose in public. You do much better to talk to them, you know, face to face. People talk about loss of face. That may or may not be true, but I think the best, most effective way is to sit down and talk them through your point of view. So you sit with these platforms on their councils or in these processes, and you explain your position, and changes do take place, and the companies are changing. If they were broken up, I mean, if that was to come to pass, you know, strangely from our point of view, it's probably to our advantage. It makes the landscape more. You know, if you have to deal with three Facebooks or three Amazons or three Googles or whatever, probably it makes the marketplace that much more sophisticated and complicated that an advisor such as us benefits from it. So I don't think we benefit from concentration, but I think the best way to deal with the concentration and the success of these companies, which have been extraordinary, and will continue, in my view, to be extraordinary, is by working with them to modify their behavior and their investments and the way they do things to make sure that the good outperforms or is greater than the bad.
You mentioned China there. You know, you've always been extremely bullish about the Chinese.
Still am. I'm actually probably more bullish about China next year than I've been for many, many years. I think China is really going to score next year. I mean, the problem is what you're alluding to, is this tension between the West and the East, or the G2, between the US and China, which obviously has become a greater in recent years under the Trump regime, but was you know, it was starting before then. I mean, America's withdrawal as the world's greatest power, America's withdrawal from certain parts of the world has left a vacuum, which the Chinese, I'm going to use the word exploit, have exploited. You know, if you look at the trade balances and funding balances between China and most, for example, countries in Africa or Latin America, the Chinese have huge positions. And it's partly because the Americans and the Germans and the British and the French and the Italians and the Spanish have withdrawn, and the vacuum's been filled by the Chinese. And so, you know, I'm a great believer in cycles. China's been on the wrong side of history for the last couple of hundred years, and many of them believe. You know, you go way back to the early, 1820s, early part of the 19th century, China and what we now think of as the BRICS and next 11 were dominant. They were 40% of worldwide GDP. They will be again. It's inevitable. So Ray Dalio, the hedge fund guy, has a wonderful graph of the rise and fall of the Dutch guilder, the rise and fall of the pound sterling, the rise and fall of the US dollar, and the rise, fall, and rise of the RMB, because the RMB in the early part of the 19th century was effectively a reserve currency, which is where it will be again in due course. So these are the rise and fall of empires, just like, you know, we were alluding to the rise and fall of companies. And these, I'm a great believer in the wave. So I think China is on the crest of a wave. And unfortunately, we're going to end up, because of what's been happening, rightly or wrongly. I mean, a lot of people support what President Trump has done in relation to China, in relation to IP and security and cyber and the like. And clearly there are issues that have to be dealt with, but there probably was a President Biden would employ a more multilateral approach. I mean, President Trump has applied, it rightly or wrongly, a unilateral approach. Maybe Biden would be more keen to bring in the Germans and the French and the Italians and the Spanish and the British and others to try and negotiate with China. On the other side, China has become more extreme too. President Xi, there are so many flashpoints now China faces, whether it be gum on the shoe in Australia, you know, Wolf Warrior comment like that, or the Philippines, or India, you know, banning Chinese apps, or Japan, or Taiwan, or Hong Kong. I mean, there are a lot of flashpoints, and that's very worrying. Globalization, with its warts, and our inability to explain the benefits and alter the public-private balance, or have public-private partnerships that would deal with the great changes, the structural changes that take place in the economy as a result of geographical shifts, globalization, and technological shifts, whether it be in education, re-education, reskilling, hardware, software. I mean, all this is apple pie and motherhood, I know, but, you know, we just haven't coped with the implications of globalization as well as we should have. And on net, it's been a tremendous advantage. I've seen that at Saatchi's. I've seen that at WPP. I'm seeing it at S4. And what worries me about what's happening is that we'll have split systems. So we'll have two systems. We might even have three. Yandex, a couple of weeks ago, Yandex buying a bank in Russia. Maybe we'll have a third system. Maybe President Putin will, you know, be so keen on bringing Russia together again, and maybe in a different form, he'll insist on the Russians having a system too. So we'll have three systems, but there will be two main systems, I think, and that will create greater fragmentation and slow growth and slow opportunity. So I think China, India remain the biggest opportunities, I think, on a global stage, along with countries like obviously Brazil and Indonesia and Vietnam and Mexico and Argentina and Chile and others, and then Africa, not forgetting the Middle East and Africa. There are tremendous opportunities, but it's going to be quite much more difficult, I think, to navigate them, particularly in the case, you know, if you're an American company and you have restrictions placed on you by an American government, you know, how do you develop your business in the second largest, what is currently the second largest economy in the world?
Yeah, I mean, that was a question I was going to ask you next, actually. For S4, is the big opportunity in helping Western brands get into China or Chinese companies moving into the West? What's your main focus?
Well, it's getting both. It's probably, and there's a third, which is Chinese companies in China. I mean, one of the things that we've noticed in recent months and I guess weeks is that Chinese companies, I was listening to a rather interesting session, I think it was a Wall Street Journal conference, one LSE professor, woman, a female professor, one a guy who follows Chinese millennials, and maybe the Chinese millennials are much more nationalistic and more fragmented in a sense in terms of the way they think about the world now than they did before. And that there is a, you know, that China is an economy which, you know, saves, has a high propensity to save, and the government is trying to shift to consumption. One of the reasons they save is because of healthcare, so creating a healthcare safety net, the development of the service economy. But China is such a huge economy. You know, it's what, 14 trillion out of 70 odd trillion. America's about 24 trillion. So, and China's growing this year. It'll grow this year. It'll be one of the few economies, if the only economy to grow, according to the official statistics. And next year they'll have, I mean, I was listening to what was happening in Golden Week, the travel week, domestic travel in China was huge. Everybody was traveling. And I would say consumption has leapt and retail sales have leapt. So next year is going to be big as GDP rebounds as a whole, not just in China, but worldwide, from the COVID, you know, downdraft, that reverse square root again, the sharp dip and the sharp flip up. So, you know, I think China is a huge opportunity, but it's not just outbound China or outbound US or UK or whatever. It's China inbound. And one of the things we've noticed is that the Chinese like to deal with the Chinese. So I think it's going to be more difficult for us in China, actually. I think, you know, the unfortunate fact is that we will drive the Chinese to become, you know, this is the inevitable consequence of fragmentation. We will drive the Chinese to be more Chinese sufficient. You know, if we limit Huawei, whatever the rights and wrongs are, Huawei or TikTok or whatever it is, we force them back, you know. If we deny them semiconductors, they'll develop their own semiconductors. So we're pushing them in a separate direction. So what will become, as we've seen with under President Trump or the populist regimes elsewhere, you know, self-sufficiency or attempted self-sufficiency becomes more important. So fragmentation becomes more important. So sort of navigating these rapids, if that's the right way of putting it, are going to become increasingly difficult. You know, sort of steering your canoe through the rapids is going to be much more difficult. Not as easy as it was with a WPP and at times like that. So the strategy will have to be much more agile and much more responsive and much less bureaucratic and probably more tactical, I think. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, we're still extremely keen. We have a good operation in Shanghai. We have a good operation in Mumbai and Bangalore, for example, in China and India. They're tremendous opportunities, and we're determined to take advantage of them.
Yeah. If I was to give you a time machine, is there anything in your career that you strategically would have done differently if you could go back and
I was looking at the questions that you kindly sent me before. So I wrote down, I saw, you know, not to, when we were acquired Ogilvy, I had convertible preference shares. I wouldn't use convertible preference shares. I'd be more careful on which chairman I was responsible in helping to choose. I wasn't solely responsible for. So be careful who the chairman is. You know, balancing career, family, career, society, the three areas of your life that you have to balance are being. And then I think the final point was, you know, a bit related to what you're saying about China. And probably, remember Arnold Weinstock, Lord Weinstock. I saw him before he died. Had lunch with him, and I said, "What do you regret?" And he said he had been too cautious. He was always quite famous. He ran the British General Electric, and he built Cash Mountain. He was a phenomenally he was a detail merchant. You know, people accused me of being a micromanager. He was a micromanager, and I really admired him. I met him through my father. I remember I said, "Do you regret anything?" Exactly, you know, sort of question that you asking me, and he said he regretted. He was very cautious. He built up big cash balances inside GE and held them at the center. Probably was a little bit over cautious on investment. And he said, rather than taking a leap, he did joint ventures. So he did joint venture, I think, with Siemens and other industrial companies. He said that was a mistake. He said, never make a joint company work. So he regretted not being a little bit more expansive and being too cautious. And I think probably that I would say the same in relation. I mean, this is all 2020 hindsight, but now in relation to China, I mean, we built a huge business at WPP in China at 20% market share, or India, 50% market share, or Brazil, we have market dominance there. So, but I think probably on the web, not going further faster. Again, you know, it's a bit the old Bill Gates thing about, you know, you always underestimate the pace of technology or the pace of change. So I think probably the answer is go for, if it's possible, go further faster. I think you always get into situations where, you always have the doubting Thomasists, which are always good to have because they bring you back to earth, and they always, but you know, the Dr. Death, I remember at Sarge's, we had, there was a guy called David Perring, we christened him Dr. Death because, you know, whenever we were going to make a major decision, we all wheeled David in, and he would always give us the reasons why we shouldn't do something. And so you've always got to have Dr. Death. You mustn't let it dominate your thinking.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of anxiety in the industry about what's going to happen now with the pandemic and the coming recessions. What advice would you give to people in terms of riding out the years to come?
I've got a bit more juice. I'm getting a flash that we're lower. Well, you know, we're in a very privileged position because we've pegged out a strategy more by luck than judgment, which is designed in a way to navigate the pandemic. And the pandemic has accelerated digital transformation at a consumer level, as you know, online shopping, online education, financial services, in home games and entertainment. All these things have been accelerated, communications online, moving from live events to virtual events. I mean, all this has accelerated acceptance of digital and digital transformation. At a media level, it's just accelerated all the trends. You know, Disney today is announcing that it's going to focus on streaming. You know, Dan Loeb writes to them, Nelson Peltz writes to them and says, focus on online and or on streaming. And they're going to do that. Bob Chapek just announced, you know, that's where they're going to focus on. So the streamers, Netflix and them, the newspapers and magazines, the decline of paper versions has been accelerated. The decline of traditional outdoor has been accelerated. And then third area, enterprise, you know, enterprise digital transformation. If there were people were resisting and saying, well, we're doing okay, you know, before COVID, we're doing fine. You know, we're growing our top line by 2, 3, or 4%. We're being a bit more efficient. We're buying back stock. Our EPS is up 5 to 10%. That's fine. Well, that gets blown out of the water by 2020 and COVID. Look at the holding companies. A disaster. Walking disasters. You know, by the way, if the holding companies can't grow next year, they never will. I mean, if there's one year when, you know, with the GDP to recover, where they should, you know, it might be a full storm. It might be the, you know, the canary in the coal mine. But if they can't grow next year, then they are, you know, they are the walking dead. But so next year, it should be possible. You know, GDP growth is going to be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7%, depending on which part of the world you are. Probably average for the world, 4 or 5%. I think the OECD report today on how they see the economy for next year. But the bounce next year. Maybe we won't continue into 2022. I think we'll go back to where we were pre-pandemic, maybe, but with a vaccine, hopefully in Q2, by Q2 of next year. But you know, I think that's, you know, the sort of the background to where we will be.
So, Martin, that was a fantastic start to the day. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Pleasure. Hope it's and good luck to you. And how's the pandemic?
Oh, it's been fantastic. I actually think, in terms of digital transformation and diversifying beyond in-person events, which we were far too dependent on, it's actually going to be a good kick up the backside for us. So I think what we were just talking about very much relates to me. So I think
a pandemic, you know, a consumer level, at a media level, and an enterprise level, huge, you know, connected TV, video.
Exactly.
Online events. I mean, huge programmatic, huge opportunities for us there.
I think so. I'm excited.
Okay. So an ill wind that blows. Nobody any good. All right.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Amelia.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye. And you. Bye.